Chapter 4. The Great and the Good. The banquet hall of the gubernatorial palace was magnificent in its way. Marble and gilt covered every surface. Statues posed dramatically in rounded nooks, gesturing skywards, fig leaves tastefully arranged. Grand floor-to-ceiling windows occupied the far wall, iron-framed with coloured glass set in obtuse pictorial patterns. The floor was tiled in some pale pinkish stone, which did little to absorb the noise caused by many feet, but which easily bore the weight of a fully armoured space marine. Tables of dark wood lined the length of the hall, groaning beneath the bounty of a world. Great platters of sauroid meat and iridescent fish jostled for space with piles of spongy fruit and immense decanters of wine. Servants, clad in fashionably plain tunics, moved silently through the crowd, seeing to the needs of their betters. Men and women, the great and good of Byzas, clad in colourful robes or ceremonial uniforms, mingled in polite celebration, the murmur of their conversation a steady susurration that filled the hall. The first families of Byzas were known collectively as the Patricoi, the Thousand Patricians. The name was more symbolic than anything. He doubted there were 1,000 of them these days. Too much war and political infighting had thinned the herd. Weaker families had been absorbed or destroyed by the stronger. But those who remained were strong indeed, and had dug themselves deeply into the workings of the continental government and Byzas. The patricians controlled most, if not all, of the planet's infrastructure. The high-yield farms in the lowlands, the ore-harvesting facilities in the mountains, even the roads that stretched from Nova Basilos, connecting it to the other smaller cities. Every decision Hereditary Governor Pandion made likely required the agreement of one or more of the families. And even those efforts were probably stymied by other families, seeking their own advantage. It was a clumsy, creaking caricature of a functioning society, somehow still stumbling along. But not for much longer. Pops of noise caught Fulgrim's attention. Through the window he saw bursts of fiery colour staining the sky. Fireworks. In their glow he saw bulbous shapes cutting slowly through the firmament. Airships were a common sight here, used mostly for haulage or military transport. He'd been told that some of them could reach suborbital altitudes, if their etheric engines held up. The anti-gravity engines were old technology, ancient even by the standards of the Imperium. The Byzans kept them running more through luck and determination than any true understanding of how they worked. It was impressive, given the planet's otherwise haphazard technological advancement and the somewhat erratic atmospheric conditions. A civilized method of travel.
"There is something stately about them, don't you agree?"
asked Chancellor Corinth. Fulgrim glanced down at him.
"They are not without their charms.
We could arrange an aerial tour of the western provinces, if you like. I'm told it's quite beautiful, from the right height."
"And from the ground?" Corinth looked away.
"Less so."
Fulgrim nodded in understanding. The western provinces had once been the tertiary continental government. After the destruction of the southern state, the west had capitulated to a more conventional military conquest. It was, for all intents and purposes, a slave state, divided up into private fiefdoms by the patricians. Reduced to poverty, its entire infrastructure bent towards the purposes of its conquerors. An unpleasant situation, and one that would have to change eventually.
"This display is impressive," he said, changing the subject. "Oh, no expense has been spared, I assure you. Whole villages in the agri-circle are going hungry tonight to provide us with this repast."
Corinth seemed determined to count the cost of things. Fulgrim had judged the Chancellor an idealist from the first, and was glad to see his suspicions confirmed. He'd always found idealists to be more useful than pragmatists.
"A sorry state of affairs."
Corinth looked up at him.
"You almost sound as if you mean that, Lord Phoenician."
"Fulgrim."
"Phoenician is not a title, but a nickname bestowed upon me by some unknown wit in my father's court. A remark on my panoply. He tapped his armour, indicating the purple coloration. You may continue to refer to me as Lord, if you insist on formality. Fulgrim glanced at him. And I do mean it. From what I've been told, the majority of this planet's population lives in poverty such that even the most wretched slum dweller on Chemos, when there were slums on Chemos, would pity them. Harsh words? Corinth stared up at him, as if re-evaluating him. The soft music that permeated the banquet hall changed tempo, becoming more rousing. Space was cleared at the centre of the hall, and dancers clad in silks and beaten gold spun into view. The crowd applauded in appreciation of the entertainment to come. But true, the potential of this world has been stunted by war, privation, and ignorance. I recognise the signs well enough, for I saw much the same as a child. Corinth blinked. A child? Fulgrim chuckled, watching the dancers cavort. Yes, Chancellor, I too was once a child. An exceedingly precocious child, I admit, but a child nonetheless. He gestured. A bit taller than average, perhaps. Corinth laughed. Belleros, he said. If I am to call you Fulgrim, you must call me Belleros, please. Belleros, then. It's good. Too much formality can make cooperation difficult. Corinth nodded. I agree. But formality serves a purpose. He gestured to where the governor sat, chatting gaily with Pike. It shields him from those who might otherwise see this as an opportunity to strike. I take that to mean that not all of your people agree with the coming change? Corinth frowned. No. Not if it means Pandion stays on his throne. Fulgrim studied him, noting the slight flush to his cheeks, the faint heat behind his words and the sudden quickening of his pulse. A mortal would not have been capable of detecting such things. Will that be an obstacle? Corinth peered at him. What do you mean? Stability does not rest solely in the individual, but in the society. If stability can be maintained by removing an individual, then it is an option to be considered. You'd kill him? Fulgrim shrugged. Or exile? A bloodless coup is achievable, even by my limited forces. He and his heirs could be easily removed from consideration. He spotted Abdomon, looking uncomfortable near the windows. He and the others had come in their war plate, as Fulgrim had, the better to reinforce the obvious point. They loomed over the other guests, even as they sought to put them at their ease. Well, except for Fabius, who lurked near the far wall. The apothecary studied the crowd as if preparing to dissect them. The others seemed to be handling things with more aplomb. Telmar had cornered some unlucky nobleman and was being politely menacing. Quinn was studying the banquet table in obvious confusion, a tiny plate clutched gingerly in his massive hands. Alconex and Thorn mingled silently, observing rather than participating. He heard the boom of Sirius's laughter and an appreciative titter from the small crowd he'd gathered about him. After long moments of silence, Corinth swallowed thickly. I thought you came to help him. The re-evaluation continued. Fulgrim could see the man's internal calculations becoming more complex. Fulgrim was neither the largest of his brothers nor the most intimidating. He was beautiful and graceful, and those things put the human mind at ease. All but the most wary quickly forgot that he was a Primarch, and not simply exceedingly tall. I came to bring Byzas into compliance. I would prefer to do so as efficiently as possible. Fulgrim watched the dancers glide gracefully across the floor. Part of him longed to join them. But not now. Not today. It does not matter to me who rules. Only that they rule in the Emperor's name. Corinth looked away. Our people have no say, then. Which people? Those starving villagers you mentioned? or the patricians who, in their ceaseless politicking, have brought your world to the edge of ruin?
Both. All men are the sum of Byzas, and Byzas is the sum of all men.
Fulgrim looked at him. You sound like a philosopher.
One has to be in order to maintain equilibrium here. Reality is a thing of competing disparities. Passing them requires a certain fluidity of thought.
Fulgrim chuckled. He'd often thought much the same about his time in the palace on Terra. Every word he'd spoken was analysed and dissected by a thousand competing factions, each of them seeking their own advantage.
Compliance requires stability. I would prefer to leave Byzas in better shape than I found it.
Meaning?
Fulgrim gestured, pleased. It was the opening he'd been waiting for.
Improved living and working conditions for the rural population. A lessening of the stranglehold the patricians have on the high-yield industrial farms of the Chalcedonian lowlands and the ore-processing centres in the Anabas Hills. They will still control manufacture of raw material, but have less influence on how it is employed. We will begin a series of reforms designed to strengthen the continental government, so that it is no longer completely beholden to an archaic caste system designed solely to prop up a few inbred neobarb clans.
Fulgrim made no effort to speak quietly. There were ears listening, and he wished for them to hear everything clearly. Obfuscation would only slow compliance. Better to provoke the foolish into action as swiftly as possible. Corinth looked as if he were choking on something.
You can't. That's... How?
He spluttered, forcing the words out in a tangled rush.
Compliance is not solely about forcing worlds to surrender their sovereignty, Belleros. It is also about bringing them enlightenment. It is about showing them, showing you, that there is a better way, and that is what I intend to do. My question to you, Belleros, is, will you help me?
The Chancellor stared up at him. He shook his head. He was saved from answering by the sudden arrival of Pike and the Hereditary Governor.
My lord, you are avoiding your duties,
the primary iterator chided.
A guest must greet his host. It's only polite.
Fulgrim nodded.
So it is. I have been most remiss, Hereditary Governor Pandion. My most profuse apologies.
As he bowed to Pandion, he glimpsed Pike hooking Corinth's arm and deftly leading him away.
Fulgrim liked the man and hoped that he wouldn't prove to be an obstacle.
Fulgrim studied the Hereditary Governor. Pandion the Fourth had been a big man once, but that mass had shrunken tight against his bones, and his flesh hung loosely on him in places. His robes of state had been cut for a larger man, and they now enveloped him like a shroud. Fulgrim could smell sickness on him, beneath the layers of incense. Despite his obvious illness, the governor seemed more at ease than he had earlier.
Quite a party, isn't it?
He asked, his voice a thin whisper.
I was just commenting as much to Chancellor Corinth, Fulgrim said.
He took a proffered wine glass from a servant's tray. He paused as he raised it to his lips, spotting an out-of-place expression in the crowd. Anger, quickly masked by amiability.
They're scared of you,
Pandion went on.
Are they?
Fulgrim continued his observation of the crowd. A turbulent knot of conflicting emotions, fear, anger, anticipation. Pike's junior iterators mingled freely, conducting subtle interviews with those parties they'd marked as useful. Later, Pike would approach those individuals herself and begin the private negotiations that laid the foundation for any compliance. The governor smiled.
Pleases me no end, honestly. It's about time something frightened them. They've grown arrogant in their complacency.
I'm glad to be of service, Fulgrim said with a slight bow. Pandion chuckled.
You've come at the right time. They were just about to become unbearable. And I'd like to enjoy my remaining years in something akin to peace.
Fulgrim nodded, listening with half an ear. He scanned the crowd, parsing body language, until he'd isolated a dozen individuals. They were ill at ease, but attempting to appear casual. All were moving, drawing closer to the governor, using the crowd as cover while they moved into position. Assassins. Their attempts at subtlety only rendered them more obvious to his eyes. Amateurs, then. He sipped his wine and blinked.
Oh, well, that is unfortunate.
What?
Pandion goggled at him.
Someone just tried to poison me.
How unexpectedly rude. He signalled surreptitiously to Sirius.
We'll alert the guards at once,
Pandion began. Fulgrim dropped a steadying hand on his shoulder. The governor nearly buckled beneath the sudden weight.
No, I believe a demonstration is in order.
Act as if nothing is wrong.
But
I have suffered an insult, Hereditary Governor. I beg your leave to solve it in my own fashion.
He glanced at Abdomon. One look was enough to alert the Lord Commander to the situation. Abdomon stiffened and began to make his way towards Fulgrim. As he did so, the others followed suit, one by one, breaking off conversations in mid-word. They cleared pathways through the crowd, moving without hurry, waiting for their Primarch's signal, trusting in him to guide their actions. Such discipline had served the Legion well on countless worlds. Fulgrim hoped today would not be the first day it failed to prove its worth.
This is foolishness,
Lord Commander Fraser muttered. The welcome gala was in full swing. The attendees were limited to the imperial representatives and those members of the patricians who had been invited by the hereditary governor, or had otherwise bribed, begged, or bullied their way into the mix. Pike ignored Fraser's grousing. Instead, she watched her subordinates mingle. Every so often, one of the junior iterators would glance back at her. She would gesture or not, signalling them to continue the conversation they had started or break it off. Compliance often started with a foundation of subtle influence. Bribery, mostly, but occasionally veiled or not so veiled threats. Overwhelming military force was good for making a point during negotiations, but other methods were required to create something lasting.
Foolishness,
Fraser said again, more loudly this time, drawing disapproving looks from those closest to them. Pike sighed.
Enlighten me, Herodotus. Which foolishness are you referring to?
This,
Fraser gestured.
We should be bringing them enlightenment, not celebrating.
We are doing both. Or do you prefer bloodier methods of ensuring compliance?
Compliance means compliance,
Fraser grunted, glaring about him. He was a handsome man, with the hawk-like mien and supercilious air the European aristocracies bred for. He wore the crimson and silver of his regiment, one thin hand draped over the basket hilt of his dress sabre. His fingers tapped a martial rhythm on the silver guard. His junior officers were scattered throughout the crowd, doing their bit to bring honour to the regiment. They spoke with their opposite numbers, taking pains to quietly emphasise the inevitable result of any serious resistance by local military commanders. Pike had great confidence in their ability to be threatening. The Archite Palatines were a blooded regiment, drawn mostly from the military households of Europa. They had participated in the Antarctic Clearance, among other campaigns, and won the right to wear the Aquila on their silver cuirasses for their heroism during the Selenite Purge. The Palatines had fought alongside several legions in their storied history, but had found their match in the Third. Aristocrats were only truly comfortable among others of their kind. She wondered what Fraser and his ilk thought of Fulgrim's program of inducting common-born Kimosians into the Legion. Then they were probably willing to look the other way, bar a few mutterings. Even the most illustrious bloodline needed an infusion from hardy peasant stock every century or so, after all. Fraser's hostility towards Byzas and its people was no mystery, at least. The noble families of Terra saw the potentates and dynastic clans of the frontier worlds as usurpers and upstarts. What worth was there to a bloodline only a few thousand years old? The aristocracies of Terra barely acknowledged each other as peers. Fruits grown in foreign soil weren't even to be considered.
These people are primitives,
Fraser continued, warming to his subject. "Fit only for the lash or the plough. What use is a planet that's already half turned to glass, because its inhabitants are too stupid to resist lobbing atomic weapons at one another?"
"Shades of old night, I dare say, Herodotus."
Pike sipped the wine, noting the traces of at least three different toxins. She frowned and glanced at Fraser.
"Don't drink the wine."
"What? Why,
it's poisoned," Sirius said as he joined them. The Space Marine had a glass in his hand. It looked tiny, like a child's toy. He studied Pike.
"Well, I'm surprised you noticed."
"The benefits of a cultured palate."
Pike held her glass up.
"It's starting a bit earlier than I expected. Someone is impatient."
Assassination attempts were an inevitable part of the diplomatic process. Usually they occurred later, when the local power brokers became fully cognizant of what compliance meant. Sirius blinked.
"You expected this?"
"Treachery,"
Fraser said. His hand groped towards the hilt of his sabre. Knowing him as she did, Pike suspected the blade was fully functional rather than simply ceremonial. Dueling came as easily to the officers of the Palatines as it did to the warriors of the Third. One of the reasons the two worked so well together.
"Yes and yes."
Pike laid a restraining hand on his arm.
"We are in dangerous waters and the fish are biting. Has Fulgrim noticed yet?"
"Noticed what?"
Fraser demanded, as Sirius nodded.
"He has. He sent me to see to your safety. Quinn and the others will deal with the assassins."
He smiled politely.
"We expected this as well."
Fraser looked around.
"Assassins?"
10 of them,"
Pike said. She had noticed them earlier, but assumed they were there for some unlucky member of the patricians. Murder was endemic among the upper classes here, whether through dueling or assassination. The aristocracy of Byzas was a glorified pit of vipers.
12, actually,
Sirius murmured, ushering them off of the floor. The crowd parted easily before him. Pike smiled and patted his forearm.
"Oh, my eyes aren't what they used to be, I'm afraid."
Fulgrim watched the assassins draw closer and fought to conceal his growing amusement. His first impression had been correct. These were amateurs. Revolutionaries, possibly, or simply ambitious nobles looking to stage a public coup. Perhaps they wanted to halt the compliance negotiations. Their reasons would become clear in time. They had hesitated when they realized the poison in his drink had had no effect, but they had found their courage quickly enough. There was no faulting the people of this world in that regard. It spoke well as to their future in the Imperium. The other guests had at last realized that something untoward was occurring in their midst. The atavistic instinct for incipient violence which all humans possessed took hold. The dancers and servants melted away into the crowd. The raised voices of the gentry faltered and fell silent. It all happened in a matter of seconds. For Fulgrim, whose perceptions were far beyond mortal, it was an eternity in which to prepare for what came next. The closest assassin stepped into the open, eyes wide, smelling of fear and excitement. From beneath his robes he drew a small, low-velocity stub pistol of ornate manufacture. A prized heirloom, no doubt. This was not simply a murder, but a statement. Fulgrim focused on the weapon, calculating the range and probable trajectory in seconds. The ammunition cylinder clicked, sounding like thunder to his ears. Everything slowed down as Fulgrim sped up. The flash from the weapon's muzzle expanded like a firework. The roar of the crowd pulsed like the voice of the ocean. The slug erupted, moving faster than the human eye could follow. Fulgrim's hand snapped out, intercepting the projectile before it could reach Pandion. The lead slug punched into his armored palm at high velocity, and the banquet hall echoed with the impact. Pandion stumbled back, mouth working soundlessly. Silence fell as all eyes became fixed on the Primarch. Fulgrim retracted his hand and dropped the smoking slug into his wine glass.
"Well, now the party is officially ruined," he said.
For a moment, the tableau held. Then a second shot glanced off his armour as the assassins recovered their nerve. Screams rose from the guests and people surged back and forth or scattered for the exits. More shots came as Fulgrim turned, blocking the cowering Pandion from sight. The slugs struck his back, flattening themselves against his armour. "Rest easy, Hereditary Governor. No harm shall befall you." He turned his head slightly. Panic had thinned the crowd some, as he'd hoped. The assassins had lost the element of surprise.
"Warriors of the Third, glory to his name, death to his foes!"
The signal given, his gene sons went to work. They'd homed in on the assassins with lethal patience. From the corner of his eye, he saw Kasparos punch a hapless gunman in the back, nearly folding the man in half. Quinn trudged towards another, soaking up a fusillade of shots. When he got close, he caught the assassin's hand in an unyielding grip, crumpling weapon and limb both. An almost gentle slap spun the screaming man's head around on his neck, silencing him.
"Curb your enthusiasm, my sons. I want one alive," Fulgrim called out.
He caught sight of Corinth crawling towards him, using tables and statues for cover, a look of determination on his face. He froze when he realized Fulgrim was watching him.
"The governor? Is he?"
the Chancellor said. Fulgrim looked down. Pandion was a bit glassy-eyed from shock, but otherwise unharmed. And he wasn't panicking, like most of his courtiers. The old man had some steel in him, buried deep.
"He yet lives. I've never seen anyone move that fast," Corinth said, staring at him.
"Oh, I am one of the Emperor's sons," Fulgrim said simply. He turned, scanning the room. It had gone quiet, save for the moans of those trampled in the mass exodus. The assassins were dead, except one who was only mostly dead. Fabius held the slumped form of what looked to be a Continental Army officer by his ornate golden gorget. One of the chirurgeon's syringe limbs had jabbed itself into the unfortunate man's spine.
"Paralytic,"
Fabius said simply, at Fulgrim's questioning look. The apothecary hefted the limp shape onto his shoulder with ease.
"Trust the spider to use his venom," Thorne said.
Fabius glanced at him, but said nothing. Fulgrim shot Thorne a warning look. The warrior bowed his head and fell silent. Abdomon signalled him.
"My lord, I've accessed the palace vox feed. It appears they had an escape plan ready, in case they succeeded. A small airship is departing the palace aerodrome, ignoring all attempts to call it back. Should we..."
Fulgrim stretched.
"No, I shall handle this. You stay with the governor."
He started towards the nearest window, pulling on his helmet as he went. As the seals clicked into place, he patched into the palace vox and sensor feeds. They were primitive, but useful. He swiftly triangulated the quickest route to the palace aerodrome. When he hit the windows, he did so with some regret. He would commission new ones from the Legion's artisans by way of apology. He dropped to the ground and was moving before the sound of the breaking glass reached his ears. Shouts and alarms accompanied him as he raced towards the aerodrome. The gubernatorial palace was a circular labyrinth of columned walkways and jutting balconies. The aerodrome lay at the heart of the maze, within the vast glass biodome that served as the palace gardens. Fulgrim saw scattered groups of soldiers in government livery moving in the same direction and increased his speed. He dropped from balcony to walkway, never slowing. He could run for hours without pause if need be, even in full armour. When he reached the outer shell of the biodome, he did not head for the one of the dozen ornately wrought bronze entranceways. Instead, he leapt onto the hardened glass of the outer shell and began to scale it with preternatural agility. The glass was divided into sections and set into a massive reinforced frame. Fulgrim ascended, following the curve towards the summit. There would be an opening there, directly above the aerodrome. If the airship were looking to flee, it would have to pass through the top of the dome. As he climbed, Fulgrim calculated probable speeds and angles of ascent. His timing would need to be perfect. The slightest mistake would result in embarrassment, or worse, injury. His heart sped up with anticipation. The glass of the dome cracked beneath his weight, and the frame bent in his grip as he forced himself higher. Through the glass, he saw the manicured expanse of green within,
wild groves of native trees bisected by meticulously arranged pathways, lined by clumps of colourful flora, chosen and placed for effect. All very tidy, if lacking in true artistry. Precision taken to excess. The glass trembled slightly beneath him as he ascended. He could see the rounded roof of the aerodrome, rising above the tree line. There was no runway or landing platform. The etheric engines the airships used enabled vertical lift. The reverberations, he felt, were the result of the top of the aerodrome opening. The roof spread like the petals of a flower, revealing the hangar within and the small fleet of gubernatorial airships. As Fulgrim watched, one of the airships began to rise. He could hear the crackle of gunfire and the blare of alarms. Overhead, man-made lightning crackled in sheets as the palace's ether domes were activated. The crude electrical fields theoretically protected the palace from airborne attack. Someone was obviously hoping the fields would also prevent the airship from escaping. He considered it unlikely, if escape was even what they were planning. The airship rose towards the top of the biodome, carried aloft by anti-gravity engines more advanced than anything else on the planet. It was smaller than he'd expected, a pleasure craft rather than a vessel made for long-distance travel. It resembled one of the ancient galleys that had once prowled the Ionian Sea on Terra. Its prow resembled a hawk's beak, and sail-like fins jutted from either side of the hull, sweeping back to meet a sharply angled mast-like structure, which emitted a strange radiance. That structure was the engine, though Fulgrim could not say how it worked. Control nodes and cogitator circuitry studded its length. Sections of it moved independently of the frame, rotating at alternating speeds. The air throbbed around it as it rose, and the glass of the biodome flexed and trembled. Fulgrim reached the summit, an open circular expanse, allowing for the free passage of airships, and picked up speed, running smoothly across the glass facets. The airship reached the aperture and began to rise through it. Fulgrim could feel the wash of the engine, and its energies played across him like soft lightning. He crouched, took a measured breath, and leapt. The airship rose, and Fulgrim's fingers slammed into the hull. The vessel sagged slightly at the unexpected burden. Exterior weight sensors brayed in alarm. Gilt buckled as he tore decorative plating aside with a wrench of his arm, revealing the bare metal beneath. He dug his armoured fingers into the metal, hooking the hull panel. Feet braced, he began to peel the panel away from the frame. Rivets popped loose and ricocheted from his armour. He hurled the loose panel away and heard it crash through the glass below. The alarms were louder now. Gripping the empty frame one-handed, he drew Fireblade and, in the same motion, swept it up and across the substructure of the hull. The metal parted with a screech. Fulgrim rammed the blade into the gap and levered it open. Pressure hoses snapped, spewing their oily contents as he forced himself into the airship, shouldering aside the ravaged metal with inhuman strength. He wondered how it looked to those unlucky enough to witness it. A giant in alien panoply of amethyst and gold smashing his way into their tiny vessel, accompanied by blaring alarms, cascading sparks, and the howl of escaping air. Some of those in the compartment fled. Others, braver or simply suicidal, went for their weapons. Targeting overlays whirred automatically, locking onto the nearest of the men. Fireblade hummed, neatly severing a hand at the wrist. The force of the blow sent the wounded man sprawling. Fulgrim turned, graceful and unhurried. His sword pinned a second man to a support strut, caving in his chest and turning his heart to slurry. Fulgrim left Fireblade there, trailing his fingers across the hilt. "You may surrender now," he said, arms crossed. There were three remaining. One had soiled himself. Two were reloading. He required at least one prisoner to make the exertion worthwhile. While they made up their minds, he took in the compartment at a glance, sparking equipment ruined by his sudden entrance. The shuddering of the deck beneath his feet hinted at its purpose— the controls for the etheric engine, and a single door, beyond which metal stairs ascended. Smoke thickened the air, rising from the broken machinery. The men stared at him, their eyes watering from the fumes.
They wore the uniform of the gubernatorial army, junior officers by the pips and braiding. Had someone suborned the army, or only its lower echelons? Fulgrim dismissed the thought. Answers would come later. The airship shuddered convulsively. He could hear a high, thin whine echoing down from somewhere above. The engines were failing. The ship was going to crash, and they hadn't cleared the palace yet. The pilot's compartment would be somewhere above. "Time's up," he said. He caught hold of Fireblade's hilt and wrenched it free, allowing the body to slump to the deck. One of the officers went for his weapon, eyes wide. Fulgrim let Fireblade drift out, removing the man's head. A slug spanged off the side of his helmet, and he pivoted, bisecting the shooter with a single sweeping blow. The third man ran. Fulgrim followed. The airship was in its death throes. The vessel was more fragile than he'd assumed. The upper deck was enclosed in a glass canopy and composed of two levels. The etheric engine extended from the highest. A rounded pilot's dais occupied the lower. The pilot's throne was occupied by a thin, panicked man, clad in a sweat-stained uniform, who fought futilely with the ship's control wheel. He caught sight of Fulgrim rising from the lower deck and screamed. Carbines barked in response. Fulgrim ignored them and strode towards the dais. His armor's sensors pinpointed five men, including the one he'd pursued up the stairs. He yanked the pilot from his throne. The man smelled of panic. He clawed for the pistol on his hip, and Fulgrim flung him aside, hard enough to break bones. He scanned the control wheel, grasping its function instantly. He caught hold of it and spun it precisely, calculating the angle of descent needed to avoid smashing into the edge of the biodome. The airship groaned in response as it began to tilt. It was already losing altitude. Whatever damage he'd done was taking its toll.
"I estimate only a few moments before we land, in one piece or otherwise."
Fulgrim turned, scanning the faces of the men on deck, even as they continued to fire at him. Above them, the etheric engine was rattling ominously in its support frame.
"Surrender, and I'll spare your lives."
They didn't. Fulgrim slid across the deck as it pitched, Fireblades singing out. His opponents had nowhere to go, and no hope of success. But they fought regardless, with the grim fanaticism of the doomed. In moments, only one remained. Fulgrim advanced on him. The survivor backed away, pistol extended, arm trembling. Fulgrim lowered Fireblade.
"You'll be glad to hear that by process of elimination, I have decided to spare you.
Drop your weapon." The man's pale features tightened. He pressed the muzzle of his pistol to his head.
"Spacious lives!"
His finger twitched, quicker even than Fulgrim could reach him, and the pistol bucked. Fulgrim watched the body topple to the deck and frowned.
"Well, that was disappointing."